you. And we're going to be talking about Jewish persecution that comes from Antiochus the Fourth. This is a part of Daniel's vision that he had. And remember, when Daniel had this vision, remember he was very disturbed by it. And the reason why he was disturbed was because he saw the persecution that the Jewish people were going to experience. This is no difference here. Remember, the angel, it says, which we determined is probably Gabriel, was telling him about the vision in which he saw. And this is part of that vision. This is a very important part of this vision because this person is extremely cruel to the Jewish people. Extremely cruel to them. And we'll talk about his cruelty as we go through this. But he was so cruel that he was actually considered to be a madman because of his cruelty. So he was cruel, and obviously he enjoyed being cruel to people. And that was just something that was unheard of or unexpected or not part of God's plan is to be cruel or mean to other people. Because Matthew chapter 25, what does it say? Because I was hungry, you gave me food. Because I was thirsty, you gave me drink. It's being kind to people. And remember, the second greatest command is to love your neighbor as yourself. This means, this tells you very plainly that this individual was not a follower of God by any stretch of the imagination. And we're going to see just how cruel this person is as we go through this. We're going to be looking at, in this section, chapter 11, verses 21 through 39. We will not get through verse 39 today. We're only going to get through about 4 verses today, but we won't get through verse 39 for sure. But we'll get there. We'll get there. All right, we're going to start off by talking about his rise to power. Now, remember, we left it last time, last week, when we left, was that the Jewish people were in the middle of a great battle. There was between the army from the north, which was Syria, and the army from the south, which was Egypt. And it just so happened that they came together in Judah. So their battle was that they were just in the middle of two warring armies. And if you remember correctly, also dealing with these armies were broken apart from Greece. That becomes a very important part here. Remember, after we see the fall of Alexander the Great, after he passes away, and we see his fall, remember what happens. His 4 leading generals divide his conquered nations. But their ambition is still great. And so what happens is they are trying to expand their section of the kingdom. And by doing so, the Jewish people are basically getting caught in the middle of it. It's not the Jewish people who are fighting. It is these other armies that are fighting, and the Jewish people were just simply in the middle. And they were suffering because of that. This right here is one of those times that we're going to talk about with this individual, Antiochus. Okay? In these ones that we're going to read today, the angel, which, like I said, was probably Gabriel, a description of a man who had brought persecution to Israel. Now then, when Daniel saw this, y'all remember, when Daniel saw this vision, he was greatly disturbed by it. And the reason why he was so disturbed by it was because he saw his people being persecuted. This is it, right here. This is one of the major ones who persecuted the Israeli people. So as we look at it, we realize that's exactly what's taking place. They are going through great, and now they're going through great persecution under these rulers. Any questions about that? This is what Daniel saw no comfort in this. But what did the angel tell Daniel about this situation? At the end, what did he tell him? That God was in control and that everything was going to be okay because God had this under control. And so it was a way in which Daniel was comforted by the angel, because the angel told him, says, you know, God's got this. God's got this. Yes, there's going to be a trial. Yes, there's going to be persecution, but God has this. So take comfort in knowing that God has it. This is something that we should do today. To take comfort in knowing that God has this under control. All right? In verse 21, which we'll start with tonight, it identifies Antiochus as despicable, and one upon whom the kingdom had not been conferred. In other words, he did not have the right to the kingdom. He did not have the right to the kingdom. He was despicable. That is a term that is given here that says that he was not part of God at all. He was separate from God. God did not support him. He had no support from God. He was despicable to God. Instead, he would seize a kingdom, the kingdom, by intrigue, by false measures, by power, by authority. Antiochus IV would engage in a conspiracy to seize a kingdom not rightfully his. So again, God had no part in his desire to take the kingdom. This was not what God wanted. Verse 22 conveys that Antiochus IV, when God not consolidated his power through ruthless measures, he was in power from 175 to 164 B.C. Now again, most of these things that I'm telling you are things that are not written in the scripture, but we know historically what they are. And so from 175 to 164 B.C. was how long he was in power. And notice what else I put down there. He was one of the cruelest rulers of all time. Of all time. Now you think about the cruel rulers that we know of, especially those in the 20th century that have been around. This individual was like them. One of the cruelest individuals of all time. It's amazing to me, and I got in this discussion this week, it's amazing to me how cruel people can be to people. This is absolutely amazing. I can't imagine some of the things that that happened during the Holocaust, some of those things that took place, I can't physically imagine people being that cruel to someone else, that they would harm someone else like that. This individual is very much like that. One of the cruelest of individuals of all time, it says. Like his father, Antiochus III, also called the Great. We know of another individual that was called the Great. Y'all know who that was? Herod the Great. Alexander the Great. Very good. He was enterprising. Talking about the fourth here. He was enterprising and ambitious. However, he tended to cruelty that bordered on madness. Cruelty that bordered on madness. That's right. Manifest God. There you go. There you go. So his attitude, his actions bordered on madness. We read about different types of rulers that were like that. That just they took pride in being cruel to people. And of course Herod the Great was one of those individuals too. He was extremely cruel to people. He also, y'all remember, he would assassinate his own relatives because he was afraid that they would take his power away from him. So he would assassinate them. They would hang people from the cross and light them on fire to light the streets. And so the cruelty of these people is just almost unheard of. Yeah. His primary aim was to unify his empire. Now notice this. To unify his empire. So what was his desire? Do what? Somebody say it. Well, they must be the king to do what?
Have absolute power.
Okay. Keep going.
Have absolute
power. What was his goal? To rule the world. To rule the world. That was his goal. To take over the entire world. That was his goal. Okay? A conflict between him and the Jewish people broke into open rebellion in 167 B.C. 167 B.C. The revolt began with an Antiochus edict that sought to unite all the people of his kingdom in religion, law, and custom. In religion, law, and custom. Now, how did the Jews respond to that? Never very well. Because the Jewish people had their own religion, their own laws, and their own customs. And by going against the Jewish law, they were going against God. And so their response, of course, is not good and led to open rebellion. The Jews were the only people who rebelled against him. The rest just basically gave in. But the Jewish people would not have it. They rebelled against him. Antiochus issued regulations against observing the Sabbath, practicing circumcision, and keeping all food laws. In other words, when they're not supposed to eat pork, they're not supposed to eat certain things, all of those are abolished. Well, every one of that goes against God's laws. At that time, you get it. It goes against God's laws. Now, one of the things as we're looking at, remember, one of the things as we studied the book of Daniel from the beginning was that Daniel didn't do the things that the others were doing because it went against God's law. He didn't eat certain foods. He prayed. He did not pray to their idols. They would not bow down to their idols. All these things were happening, and Daniel was saying, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do it. And the reason why I'm not going to do it is because it's against God. Same thing here. And that's where he attacks them the most. What is the symbol for every man that was a Jew? Circumcision. So by not being circumcised, what happened was they were known that they were Jews. He was trying to get rid of the Jewish religion completely. So in all respects, he was trying to abolish it. And so they rose up against him in 167 B.C. These revelations were followed by the words in Daniel 11:31, the abomination of desolation. Now these words are used again in the New Testament when it was talking about the destruction of Israel, Jerusalem, in 70 A.D. This term is used again. Abomination of desolation. Any questions or comments about this? You see how quickly and easily the Jewish people would rise up against them? Understand, if somebody walked in here today and said that we could no longer meet, somebody walked in here today and said that we could no longer sing praises to God, that we could no longer pray to God, that we could no longer partake of the Lord's Supper, we would revolt. Yeah. We'd still do it, like I told you before, if we have to go into the catacombs, we'd go into the catacombs. And we don't still do it.
The greatest damage he did wasn't through military, it was through spiritual conflict.
There was spiritual attack right here.
That was the worst thing, because he caused some of those Jews to, he flattered them to the point where they were willing to walk away from the Torah.
And that happens often, because what will happen is that a group of Jews will fall in line with what's being done. During Jesus' time, there was a group of Jews that supported the takeover of Jerusalem by the Herods. They were called Herodians. They were all Jews. They supported that. So, as we look at this, that's not uncommon at all. That a group would fall in line and would do what this person is requiring them to do.
He rewarded apostasy.
He rewarded that. One of the things, you know, if you know anything about Greek laws or Greek history or Greek religion, you know that the Greeks were extreme in their idolatry. I took a class once on Greek mythology, and it was just, oh my gosh. I couldn't keep up. It was this one, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one married this one, and this one had this child, and this one did this, and this one married a human, and this, they had this child, and And I just go, oh my gosh. And that's Greek mythology. And you sit there and you look at that and you go, good night. You know, I don't even keep up with all this stuff. But I didn't, typically. They didn't typically. But the Greeks worshipped many gods. Many gods. And remember Paul in his trip to Athens. As he was going through Athens, he told the Greek people, he said, I can see you are a very religious people. And remember they had a temple to what? The unknown God. The unknown God. Because they were afraid that there was some God that they were skipping. And so they wanted to make sure that they covered every God. So they said, okay, we're going to have a temple to an unknown God because there may be a God out there that we don't know yet. And of course, Paul didn't use that to bring them to where they should be, or to start bringing them to where they should be, by saying, let me teach you about this unknown God. Because to them, God was unknown. And that's what this individual, Antiochus IV, was trying to do. He was trying to force everybody to have the Greek religion. He was trying to force everybody to do it like the Greeks did it. And of course, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. All right? Questions or comments before we look at the first two verses that we got tonight? Daniel 11, verses 21 and 22 is where we'll be tonight. That's where we'll start. Okay? And in this place, despicable person will arise. But like I said, that person, that title that was given to him, or that description of him that's given to him out here, means that this person is the worst. He is despicable. He has no ties to God whatsoever. He's an evil person. Morally repulsive. He is despicable. Will arise. On whom the majesty of kingship has not been conferred. In other words, he doesn't deserve to be the king. This is not something that is deserving of him. He does not deserve to be a king. This has not been conferred upon him. And therefore, he is taking it by force. He's taking it by deception. He's taking it in other directions. But he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Now, notice what it says. He will come in a time of what? Relative peace. There's going to come a time when they do not know, they are not looking for him. Now, what does that say about Jesus? Does Jesus say something very similar? Is there going to come a time when you're not looking? You're not watching? Everybody will be going about their regular daily business? Going to their jobs, to their schools, going to wherever it may be, to the market, whatever it may be, he's going to come at a time when they're not looking. Like a thief in the night. Like a thief in the night. And how many parables, and I don't know the number of that, by the way, but how many parables does Jesus talk about his second coming when it's going to be a time that you're not ready for? You're not looking for that. And he says, when he's talking about the thief in the night, remember what he says there? He says, if the master had known that he was coming, he would have been ready. But he didn't know. He didn't know when that's going to happen. So that would be like a thief in the night. One of the things also, and Dick brought this up 7 months ago, when we were talking about the time that Satan has, that his time is very short, And when you put it in the perspective of our lifetime, it's even shorter. Because Satan has to get you to fall away. And so when you put it in the perspective of our lifetime, I want you to understand that Satan's time is extremely short. Extremely short. And we don't know when we're going to be called. I told you before about this accident that I witnessed one time. I was at this stoplight, and this lady ran the stoplight. And I stopped. I saw her coming, and I stopped. And here she came across the very busy intersection on Highway 71 South. Here she comes completely across, and this big truck hits her. And I was to her car within 30 seconds of the collision. Because I jumped out of my car and I ran to her. And she was already gone. And this was a woman probably in her early 40s. She was driving home. She had been to the store, bought some groceries, was on her way home. We don't know when that day's coming. Now, in this situation right here, notice also, oftentimes we find prophecy about Jesus coming in Old Testament because Jesus uses a lot of these same types of descriptions about his coming. Here's a description. He will come in a time of tranquility. We don't know when that's going to happen. Also, when the flood came under Noah's, realize that was the same situation. But it came in a time when they did not know it was coming. So what is the message to us today? To always be ready. Always be prepared. Because we don't know when that day is going to happen. All right? Verse 22. And the overflowing forces will be flooded away from him and smashed, and the prince of the covenant. The overflowing forces will be flooded away from him and smashed, and the prince of the covenant. All those things will be smashed. His overflowing forces will take over. Eventually. Now, let's look at verses 23 through 26. In verse 23 through 26, the narrative of conquest of Judea is described. This is where he takes over Judea. Verses 25 relates to that eventually. And Antiochus openly challenged the military of Egypt. Now, one thing about this individual, he wants to take over the world. He thinks he is invincible. And therefore, he will reach out and attack anybody. That's a mistake. Because if you start thinking you're invincible, it's not going to be long before you're about down and somebody's going to say, no, you're not. Okay? That's a mistake. In verse 25, it talks about how he eventually starts to attack Egypt. Antiochus's ego caused him to go to war with Egypt in 169 B.C. Again, he thought he was invincible. He's going to go trying to do it. It's not long before those who are high-minded are brought down to the level where they are. Verse 24 and 26 show the success of Antiochus against Egypt. Verses 25 and 26. After defeating Egypt, he displayed his accomplishments and power. Now look at what he does. This is very telling. We see this in nations throughout the earth today. He gave a big parade. There was 35,000 troops, chariots with gold and silver, 130 chariots pulled by horses and elephants, 36 additional elephants, 1,300 cattle, 600 slaves, and 780 women, 200 of which were sprinkling perfume on spectators as they went by. Now, this was a great parade. Now, remember, this is something that conquering kings, conquering generals would do all the way up through Jesus' time. And we also see that even in the 20th century. The conquering generals would oftentimes have these great parades showing their might and their strength and what they had accomplished. This is not unheard of today even. But back then, the conquering generals would display all of the deeds, all of the things that they had captured from the other nations that they had conquered, bragging about, look what I have done, look what I have brought back.
Is that what some of the Jews were expecting Jesus was coming into instead of riding a donkey?
Think about Jesus for a second. And on our story of Jesus' life, remember, within the next couple of weeks on Wednesday nights, we're studying the life of Christ. On Wednesday night, we're up to that triumphant entry into Jerusalem, which we call Palm Sunday. What they were expecting at the time of the Palm Sunday was they were expecting, here comes our new king. Here comes the one that's going to restore the kingdom of Israel, the kingdom of David. That's what they were thinking at the time. And also one of the things that they were thinking, even the apostles at this point were thinking that Jesus was going to Jerusalem not to be executed, but rather he was going to Jerusalem for the purpose to rise up his kingdom and stop the overthrow of the Roman Empire. That was his purpose, or that was their thought that his purpose was. That was not what Jesus intended, ever. But Jesus comes in riding on that donkey, riding with the palms being laid in front of him, to show the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin, the rulers of Jerusalem, he was there to show them exactly that he was going to stand up against them in those actions. He was not a friend to them, he was going to stand up against them. And during that time frame, he calls them hypocrites all. He says, woe to you, Pharisees, hypocrites of all. He calls them these things. He calls them out. And he openly calls them out. Which leads them to the point of, we've got to get rid of this guy, or he's going to get rid of us. Why is it that they arrest him at night? Because they're people. Because they feared the people. Because the people were looking for this Messiah, they were looking for this king to overthrow Rome. And all the people were thinking that Jesus was the king that was going to do it. And so they arrest him at night because they don't have any opposition from the people to do this. And remember, by 9 o'clock in the morning, Jesus is already on the cross. So by the time that people are actually stirring around, they're actually moving that day, they're actually going to their places of business or going to the market or wherever they may be going, by the time they're up and moving around, Jesus is already hanging on the cross. By 9 a.m. So realize, they did it under cover of darkness. Because they feared the people. And everybody that was illegal because even in the Jewish law, they could not condemn a man to death. They could not have a trial that was not open to the public. Even in the Jewish law. They did it under the cover of darkness. They did it only with their judges. Only with their people, with false witnesses, that could be part of it, the good ones. But realize that's what it was. Now, Jesus, when he entered into Jerusalem, did not enter with this type of fanfare. However, the people believed that he had come to raise his kingdom. Go ahead. We got Randall over there. Just a minute, Randall.
Well, they were right. He did come to raise his kingdom. He just didn't come to raise the one they were thinking it was.
Well, and that's right. Because remember, Pilate asked him, says, "Are you a king?" And remember, Jesus answered and said, "Yes." But then he goes on and says, "I am a king. But my kingdom is what?
Of this world.
Not of this world. This is not my kingdom. But yes, I am a king. Yes, the kingdom that they are looking for was not the kingdom that Jesus raised. But it was a kingdom that would never cease. And also understand this, that it wasn't until Acts chapter 2 before even the apostles understood what the kingdom was really truly all about. And thank the Lord that we, if we are Christian people, we are part of that kingdom. If we have been baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of sin, then guess what? We are part of that kingdom. All right. Let's go to verses 23 through 26. After an alliance is made with him, he will practice deception. Now notice what he does. He starts out by saying, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to have peace. We're going to have our lives. We're going to do these things. But his goal, remember his goal, is to conquer the world. Just like Alexander the Great's goal was to conquer the world. So his goal, his intention is to conquer the world. So the only way that he can do this is by deception. One of the things that was very interesting on the USS Missouri, at the signing of the armistice, I guess you should call it, the surrender of the Japanese, when that took place, they interviewed one of the Japanese generals that was there, and I can't remember which one it was exactly that was there, that was looking and watching. And he made this statement. He said, with all these nations that were signing this agreement, this treaty, with all these nations that were signing it, He said, how could we have ever thought we could have gone against so many? There's no way you can go against so many nations. There's no way that one nation can conquer the entire world. There's too many places, too many uprisings. Even with the Romans, they overextended their reach, and that was part of their downfall, that they couldn't continue to expand their kingdom. That's what Hitler was trying to do, and he overextended his reach into Russia. Now, if he would have ever stopped, if he would have stopped with the agreement that they had with Poland, because Russia came in on the east side and Germany came in on the west side, if he would have stopped right there and would not have attacked Russia, he could have conquered Britain, because he would have had one front instead of two. But he kept expanding his territory. And that was one of his major downfalls. Realize that you can't militarily conquer the entire world. So what does he do? He practices deception. He tells them one thing and does something else. And he will go up and gain power with a small force of people by deceiving others. He gains power. Verse 24. In a time of tranquility, in other words, in a time in which you're not expecting this, he will enter the richest parts of the realm. Now, when you consider the richest parts of the realm, okay, one specific city, Jerusalem. Jerusalem is considered to be the richest part of the realm. That was where all the beer was, that was where all the chalices were, that was where everything was bought. So it says right there that he will enter the richest parts of the realm. He's telling Daniel in this vision that Antiochus the fourth is going to enter into Jerusalem and is going to enter the biggest, richest part of all Judea and is going to take over. That's what he's telling them. So he will enter the richest part of the land and he will accomplish what his family did not. In other words, he will be able to accomplish taking over Jerusalem when his father was not able to do so. Now his ancestors, he will distribute, plunder, spoils, and possessions among them. In other words, he's going to take everything, and he's going to distribute it among his people. And he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but notice what it says, but only for a time. It's going to pay off. It's going to pay off. But Moses says, only for a time. One of the things I've said before, and that you'll hear me say a million times again, is that God doesn't do things in our time. God does everything in his time. But God is always on time. Always on time. So certain things have to happen. Remember when he told him, God told Abraham that his descendants will basically be in captivity for 300 years. And the reason why they were in captivity was because certain things had to happen first before he could let them out of captivity and bring them to the promised land. Certain things had to happen first. Nations had to go against God. Those nations had to be overthrown. Certain things had to happen first. And so one man was, he tells Abraham in Genesis chapter 15, I think. I might be wrong. He tells Abraham, quote, God, he says, your people, your descendants, will be in captivity for 400 years so that all these things can take place first. And then your descendants will receive the promised land. But these things have to happen first. This is another one of those situations. All through time, God's going to let this go. Because things have to happen in order for other things to take place. That's what it says in verse 25. And he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. Who's the king of the south? Egypt. With an iron dream. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army of war. But he will not stand. Because schemes will be devised against him. He will not overthrow. Those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overthrow, but many will fall down slain. Now, what is that telling us there in verse 26?
His army will turn against him?
Okay. What else is it telling us? Hang on just a second. Right there.
I think the northern king had some spies in the south's camp.
We talked about Cleopatra the first. We talked about that last time. Realize exactly what's taking place is that he will be on the throne. God is telling Daniel, he will be on the throne. But he's also giving a warning. Because at the end of that verse, it tells us something about it. Many will what? Fall down slain. That tells you about the brutality of what is about to take place. Many will fall down slain. This is not going to be an easy war. It's going to be very difficult. And many will perish because of it. Questions, comments? All right, our time is up. So we're going to stop right there with Daniel chapter 11. And we'll go to Daniel chapter 11, starting with verse 27 next week. And we're going to be talking about his deceitfulness, his deceitful diplomacy, in order to try again to conquer the world. That's what his purpose is. Any questions or comments about this?
It's pretty amazing the contrast between this guy and Jesus.
Yeah.
Complete opposites.
Complete opposites.
The only thing that's similar.
Despicable.
The only thing that's similar is at the end, the betrayal comes from the inside. Someone close to him is going to betray him.
Yeah. Yeah. This is an interesting deal because, bottom line, God's in control. God's in control. And even though this is very disturbing to Daniel, as we've discussed a few weeks back, even though this is a very disturbing vision that Daniel has, realize the comfort. comfort that is given to Daniel and the comfort that is given to us is no matter what is happening in today's world, no matter what we see, no matter how bad it gets or how good it gets, I want you to realize this one thing. God is in control. And remember, if we remain faithful, if we remain faithful, we win in the end, don't we? We win in the end. And that is the same message that's given to Daniel here. If you're trial and tribulation, remain faithful because we're going to win. Jesus has already overcome this world. The victory is ours as long as we remain faithful. Okay? Any other questions, comments? All right. Well, thank you so much for being here tonight. Is there anyone here who needs to partake of the Lord's Supper? Got one? Got two? We're right back there with Wendell. He'll take care of you. Wendell, say good bit. Susan got it. Susan got it up anyway, so there we go. All right, well, thank you all for being here. Let's stand and sing our closing song, and then PJ is going to give us a closing prayer. Okay.
All the prayers from my family, my grandparents, my mom, my grandparents' family, it's greatly appreciated. And Randall, your message when you messaged me when we was talking, you said, you know, it's having a hard time. You said, I think a lot of that would be better if you got up here with your church family and got back in church. And you're right. You know, the last couple few weeks I've been coming back. It's helped tremendously. And we'll do all three of 9-0-1.